You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me.
Episode 68, Leaping Cholla podcast, reading Heidegger's Contributions to Philosophy of the Event. And we are on section, or subsection 19, and that's of section 76,
mm-hmm.
page 121.
Yes.
And we're going to start reading through.
Okay.
After you.
19. With the ever firmer entrenchment of the machinational technological essence of all the sciences, the differences between the natural and the human sciences as regards objects and procedures will subside more and more. The natural sciences will become components of machine technology and business. The human sciences will expand into a comprehensive newspaper science whose scope will be gigantic and in which the current lived experience will always be interpreted historiologically, and as so interpreted, will be published as quickly as possible and in the form most easily comprehensible to everyone.
Okay, yeah. Seems completely true today.
Mm-hmm,
so
yeah.
written 100 years ago and now completely true. So
yeah.
The oracle spoke and we followed. Yeah.
Do
you need me
right
to explain that? I mean, it seems pretty...
No.
Yeah. Okay, let's
okay.
go on.
20. The universities as sites of scientific research and teaching, as such they are formations of the 19th century, are becoming sheer business establishments. In these establishments, which are ever closer to reality, nothing is decided. They will retain the last vestiges of a cultural decoration only as long as they must also, and for a while, still remain a means for cultural political propaganda. Nothing resembling the essence of universitas will be able to unfold out of them any longer. On the one hand, because the commandeering of everything into political ethnic service makes such an unfolding otios, and also because science itself as a business can hold its course more securely and easily without what is proper to a university, i.e. without the will to meditation. Philosophy, understood here exclusively as thoughtful meditation on truth, i.e. on the question worthiness of being, and not as historiological and system-building erudition, does not have a place in universities and certainly not in the business establishments they will become. For nowhere at all does philosophy have a place unless it is the place it itself founds, to which indeed no path could lead immediately starting from any established institution.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess I feel like I'm talking through these a little, right?
Yeah.
The machinational technological essence of all the sciences, the natural and human sciences will kind of blend together. Which I think, you know, with the experimental method and English research and humanities research and social sciences research, that's all very true. The humanities have just become sciences. And the natural sciences have become components of machine technology and of business. The human sciences become a newspaper science whose scope is gigantic and in which the current lived experience will always be interpreted historiologically, and as so interpreted will be published as quickly as possible in the form most easily comprehensible to everyone. Yeah, I mean the cheapening of the research, the emphasis on lived experience, the historiological interpretations, the newspaper science, the gigantism. I don't know. I mean, it's just all. The universities will become business establishments. That's, we've seen that. It's interesting. In these establishments, which are ever closer to reality, nothing is decided. Mm-hmm. Which I think just means that these establishments.
Yes, closer to reality in quotes.
Ever closer to reality, right? Yeah. Which means I think they become pragmatic, business-like, newspapery, current eventy. They have social purpose. They become cultural decorations, and they become a means for cultural political propaganda. Couldn't be closer to the truth. They commandeer everything into the political ethnic service. They hold their course more securely and easily without anything that's proper to a university, i.e. without the will to meditation. Mm-hmm. He's saying there's no philosophy in these institutions, in these universities, no meditation on the question worthiness of Bang. There's only historiology and system building erudition. And philosophy does not have a place in these places because philosophy cannot have a place. No path can lead immediately to philosophy that starts from any established institution. That's a very important phrase, right?
Yeah.
So, in a sense, he's saying universities and philosophy are contradictory.
Mm-hmm.
They do not exist, and in a sense, they cannot exist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's saying they cannot.
Yeah, they cannot.
Okay. It's interesting because I feel like there's such like the like promise or idealism or hope or whatever of a university or a learning establishment being a place that intellectuals gather. You know, you always think of like 1920s Paris or something, or maybe that's just me. Yeah, everyone sitting at cafes talking. Berets. Like that's how I always think of school.
Having their portrait painted by Picasso.
Exactly.
And like Stein and
you know, writing essays, you know, and or either that I think of that or I think of Warhol in the 60s, you know, and like the factory and everything.
Yeah.
And I guess like that's the fantasy, I feel like, of school. And I feel like, at least for me, it never really delivered, which was annoying. I was like, I want it to be like this, but it's not really.
Yeah.
I don't know. And I feel like it definitely calls on this fantasy. It's like, that's like part of what's fun about being a student. And why everyone wants, and I think the allure of why one wants to take part because you're learning.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. Well, it's interesting not only to think that, like you were saying, or like the scientific method is actually like not something to strive towards, which is like kind of mind blowing. Like that's just like, whoa. I mean, that's a big thing.
Yeah.
And then also just this thing that at least I have, always wanted to be I don't know if I still want to be a part of it, but maybe kind of. I'm still like, maybe they'll like me.
Yeah.
Maybe they'll like have me be in his visiting professor or something. I don't know. But like, why do I still look for that? Like there's such prestige there is really what it is. They have a lot.
Yeah. I think it's time to realize that the universities, should not exist.
Yeah.
That the social structure of an institution that, employs people whose sole purpose is to sit and think and research and that it essentially produces rot, that mm-hmm. it's ruinous, that it counteracts its very purpose. Now if you look at the university, what you have is you have kind of three elements to the university now. One, there is a lot of actual skills training. So you have agriculture schools, engineering schools, computer science schools. So those are basically trades. And they're in universities because universities can charge a lot of money for them, but we don't need universities as they originally were thought to have those things. Those could just be literally trade schools. Then there's research institute. Then there's the research aspect, right? Mm-hmm. The hard science research aspect, medical science, chemical sciences, environmental sciences, engineering sciences, doing a lot of probably very valuable research. And those are research institutions. And universities have kind of become, you know, big research institutions.
Mm-hmm. But they don't need to be related.
There can just be research institutions.
I mean, I feel like everyone I know is like, oh, I don't like writing research papers. You know, and they like are forced to. So it's kind of interesting actually to think that like, oh, maybe it doesn't need to be linked at all.
What?
Like, I just feel like it's very common for academics that I have talked to who are like tired that they have to publish, like they're sick of publishing or doing studies or whatever.
Yeah. Right. That's not exactly what I mean by research.
Oh, really?
No, I mean that there's big like cancer research institute. I mean, at every university they're doing cancer research. They're doing research.
Well, yeah, but isn't that like this whole thing that's like professors either teach or they research, and there's like, I just feel like I'm constantly hearing people being like, oh, I don't want to teach or I don't want to research or something. Like there's definitely
people who are professors.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Oh yeah. I hear that. And then the third is the humanities, where they're teaching, you know, the various human sciences. And you know, that stuff has become, you know,
politics.
Yeah. And I just think, you know, you have these huge institutions where people are basically paid to be intellectuals, paid to be thinkers, paid to be teachers, kind of teachers, sort of teachers, you know, paid to be lecturers, mm-hmm. Paid to be professional thinkers, paid to be a professional opinion makers. And, you know, I think in a sense they don't actually do real work, mm-hmm. and they get farther and farther from the actual world. Mm-hmm. And they get more and more consumed by their arrogance and their entitlement and their pristine position and their eliteness, mm-hmm. and their authority and their expertness. And of course their expertness is not limited to anything. Like, okay, you're a scholar of 18th century German literature. And so then you get paid to do that. You have a fairly cushy life. You're told that your thoughts are alone are valuable. And then, of course, you become an expert on everything. Mm-hmm. You just think you're an expert. Now, you know, I guess what I'm saying is I think that this propping up of the expert, of the intellectual, mm-hmm. through wages and you know, students paying tuition for them and everything, blah, blah, blah. I think it's toxic for a culture. I really do. Mm-hmm. I don't think they should exist. I think it's problematic. I also think it's hypocritical. I don't think it works. I mean, it's a little bit with my position of like, mm-hmm. if you're being paid to teach yoga, you're not teaching yoga. And what's more important is I think that, you know, I think we need to accept that the universities don't have to exist the way they exist.
Yeah.
They could be absolutely dissolved, especially with the internet and with AI.
Online
but
degrees.
More importantly, what you have with the internet is you have a lot of people who are sharing their opinion, researching things, sharing knowledge, sharing, you know, homespun scholarship, etc. And you know, I think it would just—I guess my sense is it would just be a lot healthier for the world, for culture, for the civic society we live in. I'm not against people, obviously, thinking, reading, researching, proselytizing, teaching, lecturing. That goes on all the time in every comment section on the internet now. But I think that a more interesting world would be one in which everyone is like everyone. There's no professional teachers, no professional thinkers, no professional intellectuals. You have a job, you make your way in the world, you pay your rent, you work, you're actually engaged with the real world of work and supply and demand and other people and the rigors of life. And in your off time, which everybody has, obviously, the internet is a big example of that. Maybe you teach a class. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe you do something in the community. Maybe you blah, blah, blah. You might make a little money for it, but maybe you wouldn't make any money for it. Maybe it's actually just all for the love of it. I don't agree with the professionalization of the intellectual. I think it ruins the meditation. It ruins the philosophy. It ruins the adventure. It ruins the verity. And it toxifies the whole thing through a presumption of expertness and elite entitlement.
And institutionalization, and then it becomes political and it becomes a business. It's interesting to think about that in terms of like arts, the arts, right? So I think we we have a similar position where like we don't think there should be government funding for arts, right?
Of course not.
Because it's like just ruins the arts.
There shouldn't be school for arts either. There should not be university should not teach art. I mean, it's disgusting.
Yeah.
I mean, the director.
So it's similar for thinking.
Remember
I guess.
When the director of the Yale School of Art joked in front
what
of the class with you? He said, "Well, we all know you have to get a license to practice art now."
But you don't have to get a license to practice therapy. That was the joke.
Exactly.
Because for therapy, it's not a.
Exactly. So, you know. It, that's what it is. It just sets up this thing where you're getting a license to practice art.
Yeah.
And, you know, it just, it's
a business.
Yeah. It spoils the children. That's the only way to put it. It spoils the children.
And I think your point about them then not needing to interact with, I don't know, real people outside of there, or supply and demand outside of there, I feel like also just ends up them not needing to do that. It gives them a lot of opinions about the real people, the normal people, and what the normal people do for work that we're seeing now. Yeah. That is really
it's not to be underestimated
it's really
sense.
Crazy.
The degree to which so-called thinking, scholarship, philosophy, investigation, meditation, is ruined by money.
Yeah.
Is ruined by making a living at it. Mm-hmm. Because you start to defend your salary, you start to research only what gets you money. You become, you know, again, distanced and alienated from the actual world of making money. You gain a sense of self-importance. You are then paid to have opinions, which is also really bad. You know, most of the professors I know, they're very combative and they're very insular, and they're very like my position. Like my dad's very much like that. You know, my position in economics is this and the other positions are screwed, screw headed. And you know, he's been carving out his little niche all his life, and it's empty. It's empty. There's just no meditation. There's no philosophy. There's no real broad thinking. And it just ruins you. Mm-hmm. It really does. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's not relevant to me, but you know, I've spent the last sort of 10 years rewriting all my plays. And there's two plays I just kind of can't find the heart to redo them. Mm. And they're the two plays that were commissioned for me. I was kind of paid to write them. And as I look back at them, I'm like, you know, I was just kind of jumping through hoops. Mm. And I think people really, you know, and you just hear from professors and people, I mean, in the arts, everybody who teaches at a school and everything, it's just how important what they do is and how they're changing all these students and how they're changing the world and the arts will save us. And it's just like, you know, you're so saturated, you're so lost in the you're so making money doing what you're doing, mm-hmm. and now you spend so much time trying to defend your profession, mm-hmm. and it just becomes this giant marketing campaign for how important their work is, mm-hmm. and it's all because they're getting paid. Mm-hmm. Like yeah. I spend a lot of time doing a lot of work. I make a lot of music. I make a lot of plays. I do a lot of stuff. I would never spend 3 seconds saying that it's important to the world. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I would never propagandize, advocate for, spin giant posts on Facebook, join organizations, institutionalize with other people, join labor unions, fight the government, fight the business. Mm-hmm. Just these people spend so much time doing this. Mm-hmm. And it's just empty. Because by and large, they're not producing anything new. They're just regurgitating the same shit over and over again. Mm-hmm. Academia is a giant repetition machine. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I've gone far enough.
Yeah. That's really interesting. I never thought. I just think you're right. We don't really.
To conclude, being paid to be a professional full-time thinker ruins your soul. That's it. It rots you. It destroys you as an actual philosopher, as an actual seeker of truth. Mm-hmm. It really is ivory tower, a bubble, all those metaphors really do apply. I know a lot of professors, and every single one is engaged in total folly. Their work is completely untested by the market, by whether anybody likes it or not, by whether it's needed, by whether anybody would buy it, anybody would want to see it. It's all just done for the purpose of how it's important and this and that. And it's and it's like, shut up.
Well, but it is a successful business.
Okay, the university is a successful business. Yeah. Yeah. We've been convinced that we need to send our kids and pay for our kids to go to these places to have these charlatans teach them crap. Yeah. That doesn't mean what they actually produce. Like, think of the papers. And think of the opinions and think of the expertism mm-hmm. and think of the teaching and think of like the plays they produce and the art they produce and the opinions and the articles and the scholarship. And I mean, mm-hmm. None of it matters. Yeah. I just don't think.
But I kind of liked my university.
What university?
Just, I liked my undergrad. I'm actually thinking about undergrad for some reason, but I liked it. But it does seem like there are different ways one could go about having those kinds of experiences.
Okay, so again, I'm not at all against people gathering and sharing knowledge, meditation, insight, dreams, fantasies, theater, art, anything. I love all that.
Yeah, yeah.
What I'm saying is the whole situation would be way more cool.
Yeah, yeah.
If no one was getting paid.
Yeah,
that's my main. It's not very deep. It's just a simple proposition.
Yeah,
that if everybody had normal jobs, like literally every single professor mm-hmm. out there right now who is mm-hmm. not teaching an important skill or doing important research, scientific research that will help someone, needs to go get a real job. Mm-hmm. And then from 6 to 8. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, they can go down to the free university, the free hangout space, and give their little lecture, right?
Yeah.
On what they want to do. And if you gave that, if that was the way things were going, and people weren't making money at it, and they actually had to get people to come to their thing, and they had to
I mean, that would make it more like Warhol in the 60s.
Well, that's the thing.
Actually,
see,
because I was
in a sense, you're talking about Dadaists and Surrealists and the Bohemians of Paris, then the Bohemians of Greenwich Village. People hanging out, doing whatever they want to do, right? Mm-hmm. Making art and hanging out, doing their thing, blah, blah, blah. The universities have tried to basically, the universities are like Disneyland, mm-hmm. in a sense, they're like Las Vegas versions mm-hmm. of that. Mm-hmm. You know, New York and Las Vegas?
Yeah.
Or Caesar's Palace, right?
Yeah.
These are mock-ups
yeah.
of some prior era,
yeah.
some golden age.
Yeah.
That's what the universities are now. Yeah. They take this idea that there were thinkers sitting around in salons doing their thing, and then they pay people to pretend to be that.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
They're giant reenactionist cathedrals. They are.
Yeah.
Filled with actors pretending to be intellectuals, making fake papers, doing fake meditation, not making any decisions, just doing fake shit, which has devolved into cultural, racial propaganda.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, that's sort of like the proof is that suddenly all professors also are politicians, right? I mean, it's that classic thing that's like, how come everybody is suddenly an expert on now the stock market and now that? And you're like, wait, I thought you were like, you know, whatever.
Absolutely. and you go and you try to cut their funding because we're like $37 trillion in debt and there's lots of people with no food and housing and anything in America. And they start screaming about how what they do is the most important thing in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And actually what they do is fake reenactionist crap. They're posing as bohemians. Mm-hmm. They're posing as intellectuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Regurgitating papers that only they read. That's the other thing. You have to think. Think how absurd this is. Academics write papers
mm-hmm.
for academics.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody reads their shit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're a circle jerk.
Yeah.
They're a self-perpetuating, self-eating, self-masturbating circle jerk of intellectual interest in each other.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow we've decided that they should get paid a lot of money to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And our kids should go learn from these people. I think the university is the worst place to learn mm-hmm. anything.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. You know, look, Elon Musk said it. You can get a way better education just reading the internet.
Yeah.
Actually, just reading books. Yeah. The internet didn't change shit. Just reading books.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyhow.
Very interesting.
Okay, yeah. No, it's not. It's just a rant.
No, it is
all
interesting.
All right, go ahead.
I think it's interesting. Okay. 21. The foregoing characterization of science does not stem from antagonism toward it, because such an attitude is altogether impossible. Science, with all its gigantic expansion today, is certainty of success, and its placidity does not possess what is required to attain an essential status, on the basis of which it could come into genuine opposition to the knowledge that derives from thinking. Philosophy is neither for nor against science, but instead leaves it to its own craving to find profit in securing ever more efficiently and quickly ever more useful results, and thus in anchoring ever more firmly the dependence of needs and wants in the respective results and in its surpassing.
In the respective result and in its surpassing, yeah. I mean, you know, I don't know what to say about that. And again, I think it's important he's pointing out that I'm not saying I'm against this. Mm-hmm. It's just that science, has become business. It's got certainty of success. It doesn't possess what is required to attain an essential status.
The certainty of success is really interesting, actually.
Yeah.
Because it kind of just reminds me of, well, it's going back to this idea of questioning the scientific method and just sort of the certainty of representation and words and representations as statements of claims to certainty and truth.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting that in a way it maybe comes all back to science.
Yeah, that's right. And philosophy leaves science to its craving for profit, its craving to find profit in securing ever more efficiently and quickly, ever more useful results, and thus in anchoring ever more firmly the dependence of needs and wants in the respective result and in its surpassing. So science quickly anchors its results to our needs and our wants, and our needs and our wants align with that result and always need that result to be surpassed. Mm-hmm. So there's always more coming. Mm-hmm. It's just he's just describing the scientific industry. I'm just quickly reminded of that debate Curtis Yarvin had at Harvard, and he mentioned the viral research, the virus research at the Wuhan lab, from which COVID apparently escaped, or some say it did. I have no idea. And, it was gain of function research, where they're like, viruses could get a lot worse. They could gain function. So we should study what they would be like if they did that. So we should supercharge them. These are scientists.
Yeah.
So they literally got grants from Harvard and various institutions to do gain of function research on viruses. Wow. To study what a super bad virus would be like. And the assertion is that one of these viruses escaped.
Wow.
And
so it wasn't from bats or something?
That's the new theory. Again, yeah. I have no idea if it's true.
Yeah.
But his point was kind of that, scientists fight for grants. Scientists fight for money. And this gain of function research was all the rage. But now, of course, it's a little frowned on. So they're sort of changing its name and doing it in different forms. But, his point was kind of like, where's Harvard's admittance that was a big mistake. And, they're not going to admit that certain scientific research projects are dangerous or useless because they bring in money. It doesn't matter. They don't care. What it's about, or whether it's worth anything, or what its dangers are. If they can get money for it, then they're going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's craving to find profit in useful results and anchor ever more firmly our needs and wants to those results.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, go ahead.
22. If it happens as it must that the predetermined essence of modern science is recognized, and so is its pure and necessarily serviceable character as a business, along with the institutions this requires, then in the horizon of that recognition, gigantic future advancements in the sciences are to be expected and indeed can be calculated. These advancements will raise the utilization and exploitation of the earth, as well as the breeding and training of human beings into currently unimaginable states whose coming cannot be prevented or even delayed by a romantic recollection of earlier and other states.
Yeah, science is going to march onward. There will always be new innovations. They're going to come faster and faster, and we can be all as nostalgic as we want about the past and some idyllic golden age, but it's useless.
But it will also be increasingly rare for these advancements to be taken as astonishing or remarkable or even as cultural accomplishments. They will occur instead in an unbroken series as, so to speak, trade secrets, and will then be consumed with their results deployed in practical applications. Only when the sciences have attained this business-like unremarkability in their development will they reach the place toward which they themselves are driving. They will then be concomitantly dissolved in the dissolution of all beings themselves. With respect to this end, which promises to be a very lasting final state, one that will always look like a beginning, science today is still in its most advantageous starting point. Only the blind and the foolish will say today that science is at its end.
Fair enough. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. The only thing I have to say about that is, you know, I kind of, as I said to you yesterday, you know, I think we're just at this point now where, you know, again, everybody's going to have a Tesla robot in their house very shortly. Things, you know, the more things are just, they're just, they're, you know, the innovations, the developments are coming in. And what Heidegger's kind of saying is that they become less and less interesting, less and less, less and less startling. Okay, go ahead.
23. In this way, science pursues the securing of a state of knowledge entirely free of need, and it thereby also always remains in the era of a complete lack of questioning what is most modern.
So that's really important. Is like we think science is what is most modern, and we think of innovation and the tools and the devices that are being created as signs of what is most modern. But I think Heidegger's point here, I think he's about to say it, is that that's not necessarily what is most modern in a way. Like the creation of tools is not modern at all. Just because there are different kinds of tools, more advanced tools, is not necessarily what is most modern. What is most modern is what has actually, what was not around when it was not modern. In other words, what is actually new, what is actually an innovation. Change in the way we think and do things and are, and technology and science don't necessarily always affect that. Technology and science have a lot of just repetition. They're the creation of service tools, for instance. And just because one service tool has a broader range of services doesn't mean that it's an actual innovation in what it means to be alive. Go ahead.
All purposes and gains are fixed. All means are at hand. All benefits can be consummated. The only task is to overcome differences in the degree of refinement and to procure for the results the greatest possible scope of their easiest utilization. The hidden goal to which all this and other things are hastening without surmising or being able to surmise the smallest part of it is the state of complete boredom in the domain of the most proper achievements. These themselves will eventually be unable to conceal the character of boredom any longer, in case there still remains at that time a vestige of cognitive power, in order at least to be shocked by this state and to uncover it itself and that which is gaping open there, namely the abandonment of beings by being.
Yeah, so in this ever unfolding new device tool implementation world that we live in, and that the fact that every new innovation is less surprising and less startling, we enter a state of complete boredom. This boredom hides what is really going on. What is gaping open there, and namely the abandonment of beings by being. So in a sense, you know, the abandonment of beings by being is something this book's talked a lot about. What he's saying now is that the unfolding science's linkage of its results with our needs and wants and its ever developing newness, which is never really new, just creates a state of boredom that hides that abandonment of beings by being from us. So this is why he's been talking about it.
Yeah, it sort of feels like this idea that like there's nothing more to discover, nothing's impressive. If you've kind of reached the end of the creativity of science, then it's just sort of, I guess, boring. And that's disturbing. Or, I mean, that's the abandonment that I guess is an abandonment of beings by being.
Yeah, it's also, you know, I've kind of felt in the last couple of decades that like everyone I know, it's like, the new iPhone is just so much more exciting than any kind of true innovation in, say, the arts or means of expression or philosophy. I mean, I think people are very obsessed with technological advancement right now. Mm-hmm. And that's just always seen as some kind of amazing development. And other developments have just kind of been pushed under the rug. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a feeling that technological advancement, like fetishizing it and following it very closely, is kind of a constant renovation or a constant rejuvenation of the spirit. Mm-hmm. But I think it might be the opposite, mm-hmm. that it's a holding pattern. It's a state of boredom. It's a repetition compulsion. Mm-hmm. And that, as Heidegger might say, there's no decisions there. Mm-hmm. Right. It's just kind of gadget fandom.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would say, as somebody who's just spent about a year and a half reading modal logic, symbolic modal logic, and the giant clusterfuck of books around that, someone who's finally gained enough sense to like abandon it, that also feels the same way to me. It's just kind of all these logic formulas talking to logic formulas, seeking the one true logic formula. In books called like There Is No One True Logic Formula, you know, it really is a retarded, rotund, circular, self, just guys talking to guys about symbols. Mm-hmm. It's there's no breakthroughs. There's no real broad meditation. There's no communicability. It's very university. It's very cloistered. Mm-hmm. It's very technological. I mean, modal logic, modern logic, you know, from Russell onward, is actually just technological thinking. Mm-hmm. Symbolic logic is technological thinking. Mm-hmm. It's implications. It's manifestations. For actually living and thinking are largely null. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think they believe that that's even important. But go ahead.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Okay, this is the last one.
Great.
24. Great unsettlement, however, comes only from essential knowledge. Knowledge that already stands in the other beginning. Never from powerlessness and sheer helplessness. But knowledge is steadfastness in the question worthiness of Bang. And Bang maintains its unique dignity in such a way that it bestows itself seldom enough in refusal as the hidden event of the passing by of the decision regarding the advent or absconding of the gods in beings. Who is to come who will ground this moment of passage toward the beginning of another era, i.e. toward the beginning of another history of being?
Yeah, so essential knowledge, the only thing that unsettles us, and I think he's just spent quite a few pages describing science as a kind of settling. Hmm. The unsettlement comes from essential knowledge, knowledge that stands in the other beginning, not from powerlessness and sheer helplessness, which is kind of our current opinion, the gadget fandom, and our boredom with technology and science's progress. But knowledge is steadfastness in the question worthiness of Bang. So knowledge is actually remaining steadfast in asserting that certain questions are really important to ask, and Bang maintains its unique dignity in such a way that it bestows itself seldom enough in refusal. It bestows itself at times, in a way, that's what he means, seldom enough, in refusal as the hidden event of the passing by of the decision regarding the advent or absconding of the gods and beings. That's a complicated sentence. So Bang essentially maintains its dignity by giving of itself in refusal, so in our refusal to participate in the settlement, as a hidden, it provides itself as a hidden event. So it's an event we need to unhide and look into, of the passing by of the decision. So a decision is hidden somewhere, the needing to make a decision that is passing by. So it's not going to be there long, regarding the coming or going of the gods and beings. So what are the gods and beings? Of the coming of going, of the truth of being, of what is true and what is worthy of question, and what could be decided upon, and what true being is. Who will help us see this? Who will lead us to this other beginning? Right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this word unsettlement is really interesting, because I'm like reading through the book right now, and he says, I mean, I think I'm like 90% through the book on my Kindle. He says that nothingness belongs to being as angst belongs to unsettlement. And he also says that wonderment is the nature of the first beginning, and unsettlement is the nature of the other beginning.
Huh.
I know he's used other words for that, but
shock.
Yeah. Or presentment. So I obviously,
go ahead.
I obviously just was like, oh, angst, anxiety. So I found that to be really interesting. And I was reading, it in terms of, yeah, I mean, it's just, I think it's very interesting. That
it's very interesting. Tell us again those two sentences. Nothing is to bang. Nothingness is to bang.
What yeah. So nothingness is a core element of bang, right? Because uh-huh. bang is about sort of the things that we don't say.
Uh-huh.
So it's a core element, let's say. And then he's saying angst is a core element of unsettlement.
Uh-huh.
So they're very tightly linked.
Uh-huh.
So
think about then that so unsettlement is our access to bang.
Yeah, exactly.
But unsettlement has at its core angst.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. But, why? Why?
But nothingness is at the heart of bang.
Yeah.
So that unsettlement that gives us access to bang gives us access to nothingness, which causes angst. Okay, so there's a whole kind of loop there.
Yeah, interesting. Right? Yeah.
And, you know, at some point unsettlement fades into nothingness,
mm-hmm.
which fades into angst, which fades into bang. So angst, or what you call anxiety, is an important bridge or part of that bang trail,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're going to try to get to the top of the mountain. There's going to be part of the trail meanders through the woods. Part of the trail goes up some sheer rock faces. Part of the trail walks a very thin cliff. And then part of the trail is scrambling up to the peak, right?
Mm-hmm.
Angst is a part of that trail, or it's an element of that experience.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you think about anxiety, say, well, I'm experiencing the unsettlement of the nothingness of bang.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which is how the other beginning occurs and how the truth of bang is discovered.
Mm-hmm.
So it's good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? You should up your dose of anxiety.
Yeah.
You want to say more about that? I had something to say, but
I mean, finish
that. That was really good. I cannot comment on things from later in the book.
Yeah, I'm sorry I brought it
because
in.
Because I'm not one of those students who, you know, jumps ahead, I think the phrase is.
You've read the
but
book.
But I need, I guess.
And I only brought it up because obviously.
I'm just saying, I need every word between and those words to understand what those words mean.
I agree. I would say the other thing that I was kind of, well, I hadn't realized he'd even use the word unsettlement earlier in the book until I saw this.
Right.
And I was like, holy. Like, I was just really surprised because I hadn't even noticed it the first time. I think the other thing that I was starting to think about in that relationship was that the feeling of unsettlement can go towards powerlessness and sheer helplessness, like the words he uses here, when you're tied to metaphysics or the first beginning, but when you're trying to take it towards or to be in the other beginning, then it, then it takes you into these other things, I guess, the knowledge and the steadfastness and the question worthiness of being and stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure what you're saying. I mean, I wouldn't want to say that. I do want to say that I'm not sure what you're saying, but you just brought up powerlessness and sheer helplessness.
Yeah.
And I think it's important to note that he says here that the great unsettlement, which is going to give access to the nothingness of Bang, and in which angst is going to be present, comes from essential knowledge,
mm-hmm.
not from powerlessness and sheer helplessness.
Right.
So maybe there's two kinds of angst that we can view existing in this maelstrom of effects.
Right. Well, that's what I think I'm trying to say is that one kind of unsettlement, like in the first beginning, that unsettlement would lead to powerlessness and sheer helplessness.
Or that unsettlement is a, outcome of powerlessness. They're very related. Yeah.
But then if we're
in the other beginning,
and we're coming out of essential knowledge.
Yeah.
Then
it's a different kind of
steadfastness. Yeah.
It's a great unsettlement.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Yeah.
Right. It's actually
What kind of unsettlement is it in the other beginning?
It's a great unsettlement.
A great unsettlement?
It says right there, great unsettlement.
Oh yeah, it does. You're right.
Right?
Yeah.
So there's like stupid university bred unsettlement, and there's actually great unsettlement.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, do you want to say what else great unsettlement is, or?
Well, I mean, great is a value judgment there. I mean, great implies that this is the gold. This is the goal. Mm-hmm. It's effective. It's formative. It's superpowers. An unsettlement mm-hmm. with superpowers, you know, I think great. It's like, yeah, great. Like, it's good. You're
mm-hmm.
unsettled.
Mm-hmm.
That unsettlement is good. Mm-hmm. Take that. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, if wonder is the essence of the first beginning and unsettlement is the essence of this other beginning, then, you know, everybody I know is still all like, it's wonder, you know, the universities are all like, mm-hmm. I wonder, we wonder, mm-hmm. but, unsettlement takes you to a different place. It's a different, and the great unsettlement is the one helps you feel like you're in the other beginning,
mm-hmm.
and it is different than powerlessness and sheer helplessness.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That's why I said it's like an active unsettlement. It's a mm-hmm. a compelling unsettlement.
Mm, I see.
A motivating unsettlement.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool.
I think I don't think we're reading anymore. I think I wanted to kind of mention Curtis Yarvin again. And I mean, I think he's had quite a couple of weeks. He had a big article about him in New Yorker a couple of days ago,
mm-hmm.
which is basically a hit piece.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But which is, it's all good for him, you know, to have them.
Yeah.
I mean, come on, have the liberal media do a hit piece on you. I mean,
you're right.
We should be so lucky.
Well, can I say why you said you started paying attention to him is because, like, you saw a hit piece on him and you were like, who is this guy?
Yeah, of course. Well, I mean, anytime the media calls somebody an extreme far right, alt right fanatic, you know that they're worth listening to. So I'm probably going to talk a lot about him in the coming episodes. I'm reading his work right now. He's a very important thinker, in my view. He's like a kind of a stunningly contemporary thinker. He's also a goofball and a cyberpunk. So he's got a vibe and a tude about him, which sort of settles in with me. I don't know, maybe, but I don't know why I bring that up. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, I guess I'm saying he's a serious thinker, but he can also come across as a bit of a clown sometimes, which I think drives liberals insane. But I just want to say that I think, you know, at the heart of Curtis Yarvin's entire approach to the world, and he's kind of been, you know, sexily, sophisticatedly homogeneous over the last 30 years of like blogging and writing, is that he's a total history punk, a history fanatic, and his position is that that progressivism has built a wall between us and the past, and that we can't read the past anymore except as a diary of barbarians, and that if you break down that wall and you actually read the past, what you'll see is there have been multiple forms of government, multiple forms of cultural structuring that have existed in societies all around the world for thousands of years in various times. And that what we have in America right now is the religion of democracy, the religion of progressivism, the religion of democracy. And that religion is so inimical, so resistant to looking at other forms of government that have existed in the past, that it blindly executes its agenda in every situation, regardless of results. Mm-hmm. And so Yarvin is kind of popular. You know, his little salt in the wound, the thing he does to like light fires and to get people hating him is say that, you know, that America should be a monarchy, right? Same thing. That America should abandon democracy. Democracy hasn't worked. It doesn't work. And America instead should be a monarchy. Now, of course, that's just a meme. That's a kitschy clicky thing. It's much deeper than that. He has some pretty shocking theories of how we could maybe have a different form of government in America. But his reasons for all of this is he's like, you know, I mean, it's pretty simple. He's like, well, look at Cleveland and look at Baltimore and look at Detroit and look at the inner cities. They suck. And his thing is kind of like, you know, progressives put forward democracy and progressivism as solutions to everything, but there might actually be aspects of our current culture where we should maybe consider something different. And we should drop the absolute religiosity of our system and think about a different system that might actually work better. And the reason I bring this up is it says knowledge is steadfastness and the question worthiness of bang. I think what's interesting about Yarvin is he actually thinks that we should ask these forbidden questions. Mm-hmm. I don't think he, and in his writing, that's kind of why I brought up his punk quality. He has views and opinions, but mostly he just wants to raise possibilities, mm-hmm. raise questions, and ask forbidden questions, and circle around the system and ask, how might this system not be the right system? Mm-hmm. How could we think about radical changes in the American structure? So he really is a soldier of question worthiness, asking those questions. And this drives liberals insane because these are questions you're not allowed to ask. Mm-hmm. These are assertions you're not allowed to make. These are systems you're not allowed to mm-hmm. contemplate. Mm-hmm. That's because liberals are institutionalized university, mm-hmm. NPRs. Mm-hmm. NPCs. Mm-hmm. Non-player characters is the new thing, right? They're just thought drones in the system. Mm-hmm. And they know what is forbidden and what is not, and they're gonna enforce it. Mm-hmm. So I think that question worthiness is an interesting thing today because mm-hmm. Yarvin is very much the philosophy of the new politics, the philosopher mm-hmm. of the new politics, and he's brought forward a lot of radical and interesting suggestions, just as things to think about and possibly question mm-hmm. that could never have occurred in a university. These thoughts literally could never have occurred. They would not have emerged from university. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So he's a total outsider, mm-hmm. but he's the perfect example of a super interesting intellectual who has never been near a university and is just out there trying to share his ideas. Mm-hmm. Like, when's the last time you actually read something by a professor? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I read things all day long.
Yeah.
And, the more someone's a professor, the less valuable it is. Anyhow.
Yeah, it makes me think, for some reason, of an experience I had today. Can I talk about it?
Of course. I'd love it if you would.
I guess what we're talking about away is like outsider artists or something.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
The sort of outsider, the punk, the like outside the institution thinker.
Yep.
Which liberals and institutions like to say is them, but doesn't quite hold given that they're in the institution. And even though even the phrase outside art doesn't really hold, I actually know the guy who runs the outside art fair, and I was like, I think my art is like outside art. And he was like, I don't know. He wasn't sure. But like, so even outside art is very commodified as a...
Wait, it's outsider art fair?
Yeah, yeah. It's Andrew Edlin.
I know this.
Yeah, we know from a long time ago.
He runs the outsider art fair?
Yeah, he does.
Where is that? Is that in New York?
Yeah, yeah.
And you chatted with him today?
No, not today. Sorry. This is, I'm on a tangent now. No.
Okay.
This was quite a while ago, like 10 years ago, I talked to him.
And he said your art was not outsider art.
Well, he wasn't interested in showing it as outsider art, but I was like, I had thought like, oh, actually maybe that is what my art is. Cause I'm not trained.
Outsider art.
Yeah. I mean, anyways,
totally
outsider
is.
Art as like a field we can drop, but like, I thought that was interesting. But what I really was going to say is I had my first experience talking with a group of business women today. There's a business coach I like, and she has her group meetings, and it's very like, it's weird. Cause like the feeling for me is that it's
was she
all,
there was the guru, the woman.
Yeah,
actually
she
there.
Was on talking to me. She talked
she
to
spoke
me.
To you?
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
I know. Yeah. It was kind of crazy.
You're blushing and glowing right now.
It was weird though, because I've seen her a lot like on Instagram
she
or in her stuff.
Her charisma all
and
over
I was
you.
Like, yeah. Weird, she's talking to me. Like I exist. Wow. But yeah. So
okay, go ahead.
They started looking at my homepage, my new proposed homepage, and the basic thing was like, oh, we don't really get what you do. And I was like, okay, well. So what I actually do is I coach models who make a lot of money on their desired monetization schemes. And I went ahead and sort of named it. And it was like, I mean, they were like actually totally cool about it. So this is like male audience stuff. I don't even know if I'm allowed to say it on a podcast, but,
whatever, say what you want.
Yeah.
Don't say the site, but
you know what we mean.
make it as clear as you can what you're talking about. It's fine.
Yeah. So So I actually said it to them, and I was like, I was really nervous to bring it up amongst this kind of crew who like seems to have absolutely no experience with it.
Right.
But at the same time, we know there are, I think my friend told me 10, like 4 million or 10 million, I was a little confused, creator accounts on the site alone. And then there are all these other sites where creators are selling their content. And it just, I thought of it because it feels very outsider. And I don't know if it, I'm not sure if it is or not, but it's definitely not talked about in universities. It's not talked about in institutions, but it's a huge part of not only online traffic, but what people actually engage in. And there's just absolutely no discussion of it or talk about it. And I've just always found that really frustrating because I feel like it's sort of ghettoizing, but also just really kind of interesting. So as another outsider, like branch, yeah. Like I feel like there's something really strong there, and for the creators who are doing it. And frankly, like we've said before, also for the people who are consuming it, why is it such a negative thing? Like,
yeah. Yeah. Nice.
What?
Yeah.
I mean, I just go way off?
No. I'm just kind of feeling like you should probably be slightly more specific about what you're talking about. Is it okay if I give a...
Yeah, it's OnlyFans. It's models who are on OnlyFans.
Yeah. Yep.
Or related content.
Yeah.
Sites.
Yeah. And that culture, that profession, right?
Yeah.
That art form, that practice.
Yeah.
That hobby. Not very discussed.
Yeah.
I mean, it's discussed.
I mean, like, I can't even, I'm like nervous to even say it on my own podcast. Where yeah. You've said everything, you know? Well,
but that's the thing. It's actually discussed. I think that's an interesting thing is it's not discussed at universities. It's not allowed at universities. You had an incident where one of your students who does it was deaf or
yeah.
Blind? What was it?
Oh yeah. She's deaf.
Deaf. And so she had a
interpreter
during a
coaching call. So we're just sitting there talking
about social media.
Yes.
And OnlyFans got brought up.
And yeah, all of a sudden, and the interpreter like had to leave. She felt uncomfortable.
She chose to leave. She said, yes. I'm uncomfortable talking about OnlyFans. I'm leaving.
Yeah.
And so she left.
Yeah.
Now, I have no doubt that interpreter was probably...
religious, possibly?
No, I wasn't going to say that. No.
What were you going to say?
My sense is that this model was using probably some kind of like free or
I don't know.
Interpreter service.
Yeah.
Right? And that interpreter service probably has terms and conditions for their people, and it says that if somebody starts talking about something that makes you uncomfortable, you should leave.
Yeah, possibly, yeah.
Right? Yeah. But I bring this up just because you can only imagine that happening at universities or that universities would be a hotbed for that kind of reaction.
Yeah.
Is that makes me uncomfortable. And that's just kind of what I mean by the gulf between what universities view as like acceptable and normal and what's actually happening.
Yeah.
That you couldn't find a better example of how atrophied and petrified the universities have become than the abysmal chasm between what they view as like acceptable and normal behavior and what the rest of the world is like completely engaging in all the time.
Yeah.
I mean, OnlyFans is not a swear. It's not like nobody's heard of OnlyFans. I mean, OnlyFans is everywhere and people talk about it all the time. It's all over. It's everywhere. It's as common as donuts and Budweiser, you know?
No one has ever talked to me about OnlyFans, like, in like a social situation.
Yeah, no, it's not acceptable.
Yeah, so it's everywhere, but it's not acceptable.
You know, you hang in some pretty university.
Yeah, that's circles. True. Good point. That's a good point.
So, but I think in the larger picture, this is interesting because the question of outsider, you know, the universities determine what is outsider. Mm-hmm. Outsider mm-hmm. is outside the universities. And even that is a problem, that the universities are the inside and that they're hooked up with the inside and they shouldn't be. Mm-hmm. There shouldn't be any inside or outside. University rankings is disgusting. Like, whoever came up with that? Like, that just makes no sense. Right? So now some people are going to subpar universities. Some people are going to, like, if there's anything that, you know, what a person puts into it is what they get out of it, it's like college. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So, there's just a lot of problems. The university has a lot of problems, and I think they're facing them now. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to think of a world where there aren't universities, that there's other forms. And then you would have things like where there's no outsiderness and there's no ghettoization and there's no silencing and there's no sense of like what's proper. Mm-hmm. And where what's happening in the real world is what people are actually thinking and talking about. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.
Because I also think that you have not enjoyed being an outsider.
Yeah, I think that.
I don't think it's, speaking of, I don't think it's settled well. I think it unsettled you.
Yeah, well. I mean, maybe it's because I come from a university family.
Yes, you do.
I think that...
Well, you not only come from a university family, you...
And I was an excellent university student. So I do think there is something, the leaving... Well, it's, you know, it's like leaving a religion. You get anxiety from leaving a religion or something, right?
I get an erection. But, So I think that in the incident or the event, we should say in a Heideggerian sense, of you being made into an outsider by a university liberal cathedralist system is unsettling.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So now you need to ask yourself, is it a great unsettling? Or is it a helpless, powerless unsettling? How have you appropriated that unsettlement? Have you let it instigate a steadfastness in the questionworthiness of bang? Or have you perpetuated that sense of helplessness and powerlessness and victimization and just made it unsettling? So it needs to be a great unsettlement.
Yeah.
And then I'd almost say, you know, you could then maybe convert your anxiety to angst. Maybe there's a difference between anxiety and angst.
Yeah.
And instead of anxiety, you should feel angst.
Right. I've never quite thought, they are different. That's right. Yeah, that's nice.
All right.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah. Well, good night, everyone.
Good night.
And I feel like I was a little cranky and a little acerbic.
We know you love all your family and friends.
Yeah. I don't know about that. But I'm a little sick. I'm a little cranky. I've been coughing for 10 days.
Yeah, we've actually haven't recorded in quite a while, which is unusual.
Yeah, I'm just under the weather. You can hear it in my voice, but... I'm not as mean or as bitter as I sound. I don't know. All right. That's it. I just thought I'd say it at the end. All right. Good night.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Cholla podcast. For more information, visit leapingcholla.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.